you're very welcome. My name's Kerry Thomas, and great pleasure to have your company on one of these big days of the year when something has happened yesterday which we can really get our teeth into, because a lot of hopes were riding on the Chancellor's spring statement yesterday. Not surprising, I think, when the economic outlook has become so bleak and so uncertain, and all the things that we were worried about before the war in Ukraine, supply chain issues, energy prices, general inflation, have got much worse because of the war. And the scale of the cost of living crisis, I think, is really now staring us in the face. So the word before the spring statement was that the Chancellor had perhaps a bit more wiggle room than we'd assumed, because tax receipts were coming in higher than expected. So the question was, how much help could Rishi Sunak give to struggling people and businesses, and where would he direct it? Well, we know the answers now. And fortunately, we've got three great people with us to help us figure out what they mean for the economy, for people, for businesses. We've got Rain Newton-Smith, CBI's chief economist. Great pleasure, as ever, to have you with us, Rain, morning. And then we've got Nicole Sykes, who's director of policy and communications at Pro Bono Economics, which many of you will know works with charities and social enterprises with a particular focus on well-being. And then we've got Nigel Pocklington, who's chief executive of Good Energy, which is one of the UK's leading renewable energy suppliers. Rain, let's start with you. Can you just start us off with the big picture, your sort of general reflections on the Chancellor's spring statement and the context in which it was delivered?
Yeah, look, I think it was a really difficult moment to be presenting an economic forecast. I think the Chancellor had hoped that we'd be, you know, he'd be able to be presenting good news. And I think while he has had some good news on the public finances, the outlook for growth and particularly inflation is pretty bleak. So the OBR set out their growth forecast for this year. They now expect growth of about 3.8% and then falling below 2% next year. But I think the thing that really caught everyone's attention was the forecast for inflation. So inflation over the course of this year is expected to average 7.4% and will peak. They think it will peak at 8.7% in the final quarter of this year. Now, there's a bit of uncertainty around those inflation forecasts because the energy price has softened a little bit since the OBR closed their forecast. But I think what we do know is we are going to see numbers around that. And of course, that means actually households at the, you know, the bottom 20% of the income distribution who spend more on food and fuel, because that is where the majority of the inflation is coming and will be more exposed. And we'll see inflation rates much closer to 10% on average. But partly because growth up until now and income tax receipts and general tax receipts have been stronger than expected, he actually did have a better outlook for the public finances. And while there was some impact from index-linked bonds and interest payments this year further out, the public finances have improved because essentially inflation adds to tax receipts. So he did have some money to think about how he would spend that. But I think the Chancellor didn't want to, you know, he always wanted to move to one fiscal event. And I think in the back of his mind, he's also thinking, look, there are some real risks out there. And the terrible conflict in Ukraine is obviously at the forefront of everyone's mind. And unfortunately, the pandemic hasn't completely gone away, and there's always the risk of other variants. So I think he did take some decision to bank some of that improvement in public finances and keep that back for the future. I think from our point of view, one of the things that was really important is he did set out a sort of vision for what he thinks will drive growth and productivity over the long term, and a real clear focus on trying to increase business investment, having a more flexible approach to skills and training. But I think the disappointments from business are a couple of fold. One, there wasn't anything on to help businesses deal with higher energy costs that they're dealing with now. And I think particularly smaller businesses really exposed. And he could have looked at the loan scheme available just to ease some of the pressures on the cash flow without, you know, making direct grants. And then the other thing is we've really been hearing from our members just, you know, that now is the moment to accelerate our transition to a green economy. If we're thinking about our energy security and more broadly, we really need to accelerate our transition. And he did a few measures, but they felt a bit more like tinkering around the edges. It's something we've called for around bringing forward business rates relief for investing in green technologies, but it could have seen much more fundamental reform of that system to really get green investment. And some measures as well around VAT on energy-saving materials in construction. But that was an overall measure costed at about 50 million, where we were sort of thinking there'd be a, we want to see that 5 billion set aside to improve energy efficiency in homes. So I think there's definitely a need to really accelerate some of that spending on the green transition. And I'll stop there. There was much more around. I'm happy to go through the national insurance changes, because obviously that was a big change he did make, was lifting the threshold on national insurance payments, which will help people in work, particularly those on lower income.
OK, I'm sure we'll come back to that. On the sort of that sense of Rishi Sunak sort of keeping his powder dry for the autumn, right? I was watching him deliver the speech and thinking he feels like someone who's really trying to get away with doing as little as he possibly can. But actually, you're painting a slightly different picture and saying that there perhaps is an economic case, given the scale of the uncertainty that exists out there, for a degree of prudence now to just give yourself more options in the autumn. And he may have been thinking along those lines.
Yeah, I think that certainly was in his mind. He'd sort of hoped, like so many of us, right? He hoped he wouldn't be here, right? And I think he's been hoping life will return to normal, and he can have one fiscal event a year where he sets out his vision for the economy. He does things on tax and spending. And so I think he was hoping this would be quite a light touch spring statement. But then in the end, we were in a completely different world. And so I think he did do some changes on national insurance for individuals, the threshold at which they pay. He looked at the employer allowance as well and lifted that for small businesses. But they're relatively small measures, I think, given the scale of the challenge we face. And so I think part of the motivation may have been, let's wait and see where we are in the autumn, and when some of the pressures around winter fuel, et cetera, may be getting worse. But I think the challenge he faces is so many households and so many businesses are saying, look, we know the next 6 months are going to be really tough. We don't know whether we can last until the autumn.
And from the CBI's perspective, I think if you look at the coverage this morning, this is not a budget that in its first 24 hours has gone down particularly well. There's a little bit of sense of disappointment around business as well. What does the CBI do now to change the weather for the autumn budget or whatever the priority is?
I think for us, it's really focused on, what he set out around how he will lift growth and productivity. And he put down some really clear markers that he will act on that in the autumn. So he has promised that when the super deduction comes to an end at the end of 2023, there will be incentives for business investment that make the UK internationally competitive. So that's really important. We know that corporation tax is going from 19% to 25% in 2023, but looking across the whole spectrum, he'll make sure that there is an incentive for investment. And he included in the options, he had some quite clearly costed options. So he's put some real thought into that. 100% capital allowance, that sort of permanent deduction, which we think we've recommended is down there as one of the options. So one of the things we'll be working with the Treasury and keen to hear from businesses across sectors, across size of company, is essentially the exam question. What incentive around business investment on the tax side really makes a difference to the investments you will make, whether they are in green technologies or digital technologies or wider infrastructure? So that is our exam question, where we will be trying to provide the evidence to the Chancellor on the most cost-effective option. And then the second big area is really about skills. He has said that he will have a much more flexible system that isn't just reliant on the current form of the apprenticeship levy. And we know from so many businesses, it's just not fit for purpose in the skills we need around sustainability, around a digital economy. So a much more flexible approach, and we'll be keen to work on that. And then I think the final bit is really thinking about the energy plan. The Chancellor, the Prime Minister, will be setting that out in the coming weeks. And we really want to see, and I'm sure Nigel will talk about this as well, a system that works. It really helps with that transition to a low carbon economy, acknowledges gas and other fossil fuels are part of that transition in the near term. But we need to be increasing hugely the amount we're investing in renewable energy and in energy efficiency itself.
Rain, thank you. We'll come back to you very shortly, I'm sure. Let me turn to Nicole, if I can. Morning. Thanks for joining us. As I mentioned, pro bono economics deals largely with charitable and social enterprise sectors. In other words, with a lot of people who are going to be picking up the pieces when the cost of living squeeze really hits. Before we come to the statement itself, what was the sort of state of play? How robust was that sector or those sectors going into yesterday's spring statement?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the charity sector has been under a lot of pressure over the last 2 years. Looking back, about 1 in 4 charities ended up with an income drop of about 40% over the pandemic because they couldn't fundraise. You couldn't have a fun run, you couldn't have a big dinner. Lots tried to make the transition to digital, but it just wasn't the same in terms of scale. So huge drops in income for a lot of the sector. And at the same time, they were having to work harder than ever before. Demand was extraordinarily high, particularly for those working with those individuals on low incomes that we're talking about today. Also providing mental health support, also helping tackle some of those backlogs in the NHS and the justice system. We surveyed the charity sector back in October, and already 75% of charity managers were concerned about burnout in their workforce. So 3/4 already very concerned. Now moving into this period, that's not going away anytime soon.
So what were your hopes from Rishi Sunak yesterday?
So I think our biggest hope was around sort of the benefits uprating. Benefits will rise. They'll rise by about 3.2% in April. But obviously we know, as Rain was saying, that inflation is much higher at sort of 6 to 8%. And that is a huge actual loss for those people in terms of the money that they have available. And as Rain was mentioning, those on those lowest incomes, those on universal credit, very, very exposed to inflation because it's being driven by food and fuel, and that those sort of things aren't negotiable. Saying that, people are having to make those choices about whether or not they can afford food or fuel, having to make those choices between the two. I think it's also worth noting that, again, even before inflation was rising, sort of what some of those choices looked like. 1 in 3 of the lowest income households were struggling to make their housing payments. And 4 in 10 were concerned already about their levels of debt. So we are looking at sort of quite a serious situation for this group of people. And if charities are coming under strain, you know, if the benefit system isn't sufficient to support them, and the charity system, which is sort of the fallback that we rely on, is also under particular strain, that's sort of, people run out of options.
And if you look sort of up a quartile or two beyond the benefit system to people on low incomes, what's the picture there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth noting that even people on low incomes are still supported by the benefit system, and a significant number of people on benefits are in work. If you want to look at sort of across pay levels, for example, we know the aggregate pay of those on the basic rate of income has risen about 4.4%, but those on higher incomes and additional, higher tax and additional tax levels, their aggregate pay has risen by 20%. So you're looking at sort of a slightly uneven pay situation for these individuals. And I do think it's important that as we look at this and as we turn to sort of what business can do in this space, it is actually having to consider, you know, if a significant number of these people on low incomes are in work and are moving into poverty, what businesses can do to address that within their own workforces.
And if I think about a food bank, let's say, which, you know, I imagine is an enterprise that's going to come under a lot more pressure in the next couple of years, the way things are looking. What challenges are food banks in particular going to face, do you think?
Yeah, so food banks will be hit on the demand side as more people turn to them. They're also quite likely to be hit on the donation side as sort of people on middle incomes having to, you know, turn up to the supermarket, trying to work out how you feed your own family, and then the additional cost that comes with donating. As you know, that sort of can or that good that you were looking to put in that tray actually costs you more as well when you are struggling. For charities, sort of income roughly tracks public consumption for the charity sector overall. So we're now forecasting, based on yesterday's figures, a £2 billion fall in charity income, sort of totaling a £5 billion fall for the sector as a whole over the sort of entire pandemic period, which is a big struggle for people to kind of rebound from as sort of demand continues to increase. I think the other thing to note, of course, is that food banks don't just provide food, and the impact isn't just on sort of your ability to afford essential goods. Or, and when I say essential goods, I also mean, you know, there are plenty of charities providing kids mattresses and fridges and, you know, the sort of things that a lot of us take for granted. But those food banks are also connecting people up with debt services. They're also connecting people up with mental health services, helping people look after their children so that they can spend more time in work. So there are lots of different elements of the charity sector. It's not just sort of that that sort of front face that a lot of us might be familiar with. There's a lots of parts of the charity sector that will be impacted by this.
Okay, great, Nicole. Thanks for that. Nigel, let me turn to you, and if I can use you first of all as a kind of to give us a view for across energy as a whole, because I think it obviously looms large in people's worries about the coming months, and it looms large in inflation. Given all that, and given the effect, particularly that it will feed into the cost of living crisis, to what extent do you think the spring statement supported households and businesses in the way that people thought the Chancellor might?
I think it was very disappointing from an energy point of view, really. And that's partly, I suspect, because they do have an energy strategy to come, so there may be more news there. But the spring statement didn't really move us on any further from the responses they announced when the domestic standard variable tariff price cap increase was made in February, which is that he referred once again to his rebate scheme, which is the as yet, you know, undesigned process of putting £200 back into your bill in the autumn and then adding £50 further on. And there wasn't much really, apart from an addition of £500 million into the sort of household support scheme, which is money that local authorities can use for people in dire straits. And that concerned me, really, because I think it was a bit tone deaf to a crisis that, whilst it's certainly not his making particularly, is a very here and now crisis for households, for businesses. And, you know, the response 2 months ago was inadequate for the lowest quartile of incomes. And we're still in that position. So you've still got people with these awful sort of heat or eat kind of choices right now. And whilst he's right, and the OBR are right, so they don't quite know what's going to happen in energy prices. You're not going to find anybody working in the energy industry who's going to take a bet that they're going to fall. You know, they will go up again, and that will be a source of further anxiety. And we're better off getting ahead of this now and having a kind of proper coordinated approach to a very high period of energy prices, and we don't have it. And there are untouched parts of this story which don't get a lot of coverage. But for example, there are a million households in the UK who are actually off the gas grid, and they use oil or bottled gas for heating. The price of heating oil has pretty much trebled in the last month. You know, it's a diesel derivative. It's in short supply and may actually have a supply crunch. And that's causing, you know, even more pain, frankly, than for people who are on the standard variable tariff. So, you know, it's an incredibly difficult story. It touches us all. And I don't see enough sign of proper government grip on it.
No, it's actually really hard to get hold of heating oil, I know from a bit of personal experience. Part of me wonders whether to have some sympathy for the Chancellor, because given, as you said, the scale of the energy price rises, probably a 40% rise in the energy price cap in April, potentially another 50% in October, whatever, I forget what the figures are, but something of that order. What do you think his realistic options were yesterday that he didn't take?
You're right. It's an extraordinary market shock, reminiscent really only of the oil price crisis of the 70s in terms of magnitude. That was a 3.5-fold increase in the price of oil during the year. Actually, gas is nearer 5 or 6 times at times at the moment, so arguably bigger. So whatever he did was going to involve serious and tough choices. There are a couple of areas which I think could make a big difference to bills that repeatedly they don't engage with. And those are, first off, the treatment of the cost of failed suppliers. So we are 28 energy companies failed last year. And under the scheme which recovers customers, eventually the people who take on these customers can get back the additional cost. And the way that cost is recovered is through the standing charges on your bill. And so we've all, you know, been hit to the tune of about £70 for those. There was no real reason, as far as I can see, why you couldn't sort of smooth out the impact of that over a longer period. It's a pretty guaranteed stream of income. Somebody would have financed that. And the second area, which this is sort of stubborn, is the social and environmental costs on the bill. Now, and this is becoming quite a contentious political issue. Nigel Farage is agitating for a referendum even on some of these points, albeit with erroneous data in his statements all the time. But we are paying for household insulation schemes, the warm homes discount scheme, and various, you know, I'm sure very necessary social measures through electricity bills. And it's a pretty regressive form of taxation, frankly, for something that, if you think it's a societal good, should be on general taxation. So there was an opportunity which they repeatedly turned down to take some of those elements of the bill, which, you know, are worth up to £200 in that 1971 price cap figure, and put them through general taxation as well. So that he has options to take, you know, a useful £200 or £300 further off the bill if they want to, but they've kind of shied away from those so far. Whilst it's sort of churlish somewhat to say that the £200 rebate scheme that they announced in February, you know, is unwelcome. Everyone would, you know, it is a bit of a gimmick, if we're honest. It's kind of ill thought through. It's still in consultation with the energy industry, who aren't entirely clear how on earth we're going to implement this change. And it's not necessarily that suitable in a world where it's, you could probably expect bills to rise again. So yes, you've got a £200 rebate in October, but you've got £50 on a bill that's going to go up again anyway in the new year. So, and, you know, whilst I've got some sympathy with him, I don't think they're playing the cards they've got that well.
Okay. And Nigel, on the things that the Chancellor did do on home insulation and those kind of things, what concrete measures did he announce yesterday?
Yes, there were a couple of, I think, welcome changes to tax incentives. One's for domestic customers and one for businesses. So there was a bring forward to next month of a sort of a rates rebate for businesses investing in on-premises green technology, so effectively solar panels on the roof or a wind turbine. That's very welcome. And I think is genuinely, provided the business has the sort of capital to put behind that, a cost-saving measure. The payback on installing solar panels at these energy prices is really sort of a four-year or so period now. So it's quite a worthwhile thing to do. And the same applies to household green technology and insulation. It's odd that the sort of home insulation has become rather politicised as an issue thanks to the antics of the M25 protesters. And that's terrible, really, because actually it is a very central part of the story in the UK. You know, we do have the worst insulated and least heat efficient housing stock in Europe. It's just a function of when they were built and relatively benign energy environment for many of the years around it. If we fix that, you're talking about a £300 to £400 saving on most people's bills. So any incentive to improve insulation or adopt green technology is welcome. It's not necessarily huge. You know, aficionados of budgets and spring statements might remember that the cut to the green crap budget that came after the Omnishambles budget during the Cameron government, where they actually dropped some quite generous insulation schemes, and it did have a marked impact on rates of loft and cavity wall insulation in the UK housing stock, which we're still sort of paying for. So there's more you could do, but I welcome them, and they are genuinely helpful measures for people who have the capital to deal with an ongoing issue over several years. What, of course, they can't do is deal with the inability to pay your bill next month.
And just before I come back to Rain, Nigel, just to pick up on that point, is the sort of net effect of what you heard yesterday that a company like Good Energy now has to rethink its strategy for how it's going to deal with people who are really struggling over the next 6 months?
We are always immensely sympathetic to that in terms of payment plans for people who are coming into debt, being very clear about what our charging and tariffs are, and looking to help people with insulation and other schemes. There is unfortunately quite a limit to what your energy supplier, however purpose-led they are, can do. I'm sort of quite proud to say I run one of the small handful of actually profitable energy supply businesses in the UK, albeit that the couple of millions of pounds of profit that we've made over the last few years isn't going to make a difference. You know, these companies run on very thin margins. The price cap, whilst it does offer some protection to consumers, is not a well thought through measure in terms of maintaining and growing a vibrant energy supply sector. And there will be a real limit to what energy suppliers can do, given the constraints we're operating under and the pressures we're operating under from this marketplace.
Nigel, thanks so much. Rain, you've pointed us towards measures that the Chancellor is promising to take later to do with business investment and transitioning to green energy and so on. But particular measures that were announced yesterday, what was there in the spring statement directly aimed at businesses now?
So I think there weren't a huge amount of measures that were actually announced yesterday that will help businesses directly, though obviously the announcement on national insurance and the future cut in income tax will, relative to what would have happened otherwise, will provide households with more income. But as Nicole was saying, there's still a huge challenge for people who aren't in work. And we're still seeing in general a squeeze on people's living standards in real terms. And he sort of set out the long-term plan. Obviously, there was the cut in fuel duty of 5 pence. That will help, people who are, when they're filling up at the pump. And of course, around 40% of those people filling up are actually businesses as part of their journey, whether you're a coach company, etc. But obviously, that's on the back of energy prices, which have risen a lot. So, and actually, interestingly, even I think for many businesses are sort of saying, is that where we, given the limited resources, is that where efforts should have been directed, given there could have been more incentives to accelerate our green transition? But I think what he did say on capital allowances is, and I think we do, it's because what businesses say to us, when they're making investment plans, they are making decisions now that they will implement post 2023. So I think looking ahead to what the regime will look like post 2023, he set out a range of options. And post 2023, the super deduction comes to an end, which is 130% of writing off your capital. And there's also the annual investment allowance, which is currently at 1 million, and that's set to drop down to 250k back to its sort of so-called normal rate post 2023. So he really does need to do something to incentivize investment. And he set out a range of options, either that 100% allowance or looking at the annual investment allowance and raising that to 500k, or it's a drop from 1 million, depending on which way you look at it. But I think he is interested in ideas about what is most effective. So we're keen to work on that. The other thing he did announce on the R&D tax credit, which is important, is expanding it to look at fundamental maths research, but also cloud computing and data processing and data storage, which is something that we've been calling for. Just to sort of, the R&D tax credit has been seen as really successful internationally as well, but certainly in the UK at promoting more innovation, but just modernizing that for some of the ways in which businesses do innovation. It's so much about data, cloud computing, data processing. So I think that was a welcome measure. But I think, as Nigel sets out, it's put a lot more pressure, I think, on the energy plan that's due to come, because they felt like there were many things that weren't really addressed in the spring statement. How do we help smaller businesses deal with higher energy costs? How do we help energy companies deal with a system where the regulation isn't really working well? And how do we accelerate our move towards more renewable sources of energy?
Okay. Ray, let me put to you a question that's come in from Daniel Rumley, who says we've got a large anaerobic digestion plant creating green electric and gas and selling all that into the grid. We've seen our business rates double this year. Does the incentives / VAT relief announced in the Chancellor's spring statement mean that these rates will drop?
I would hope so, but I'm not sure whether that will be the case, because this is one of the challenges we've heard from some businesses, is that because the price of electricity, et cetera, has gone up, so therefore, when they've installed energy saving measures, because the value of that is now higher, their business rates, rateable value is potentially going up. So, and I think what the incentives that what have been brought forward is, if you make an investment in a green technology, as Nigel was saying, like a wind turbine or a solar panel, then you can get some relief from that. They were going to bring that in, but they brought forward that relief is something which we called for. But I think one of the challenges, and something we've been pushing for, is that actually the business rate system as a whole, there are many ways in which it actually disincentivizes investment in green technologies and energy efficiency. And so we have been calling for that much more fundamental reform. But there are quite a lot of open consultations on that. So I'd be keen, do drop a line to insights@cbi.org.uk, because those are the examples which armed with, we're really able to make the case with Treasury about how this does make a genuine difference on the ground.
Right. Nigel, before I come back to Nicole, let me just pick up on something that Rain was saying a few minutes ago. So the R&D tax credits, the measures to do with cloud computing, data processing, I imagine those are quite big areas of activity for you. Have you had a chance to look at whether what was announced yesterday is going to make a big difference to good energy or a small difference?
I mean, at face value, a small difference. All these things are welcome. So you sort of go through your project stack and the investment areas, and you're right. You know, even an energy company, or especially an energy company, needs to invest behind digital technologies and the use of data to help, you know, understand consumption patterns better. So, you know, there is something in there. That's certainly, and I know from my non-executive part of my career as well, that these are hugely important areas for innovation and expansion and improvement in productivity. So, you know, that's a welcome nod in the right direction, I think. And, you know, actually using this kind of technologies in terms of the future of the electricity grid and the energy grid is going to be incredibly important to us, because, you know, what is becoming clear is that what might have been a great solution in the 90s for a sort of marginal cost driven approach to generators coming onto the grid and setting the overall price of electricity isn't working at the moment and is less helpful in a renewable era. So your ability to use data to manage that differently, for example, is an area the energy industry will be looking at. So some small help there. It's certainly a lively area.
Yeah. Okay. Nicole, let me come back to you. I'm interested in, we're painting quite a bleak picture of real pressure on low and middle income households, but benefits and real wages under sustained pressure, inflation high and high for quite a long time. In all that, what do you think the role and responsibility of businesses and employers is in you know, helping in whatever way they can?
Absolutely. And if I can talk really practically, if that's useful, I think over the pandemic, we've seen a huge amount of investment from businesses in the support that they provide on mental health and wellbeing. I think sort of encouraging staff, making sure that awareness of what you do offer on mental health is a really important thing to do at this moment in time, particularly, as you say, sort of if there is any help, maybe it comes in autumn, but nothing before then. So raising awareness of what businesses already do on mental health, I think, is really important. Sort of Nigel mentioned the sort of when it comes to consumers and customers, sort of energy companies and banks do have very good sort of partnerships and things with charities to help. You know, it's in no one's interest for people to get trapped within problem debt and not able to pay you. So sort of having another review, having a look to see, are we doing everything that we can in this area to help make it easier for people to pay back? Ultimately, though, I think if businesses feel very passionately about CSR, about their ESG commitments, I think this has the potential to be sort of a 2008 moment in some ways. Look, we're not in a recession, but it will feel that way for a number of people. And I think how businesses come out of that is incredibly important. We know that from last time. We should be thinking about this now and engaging with lower paid members of staff to understand the pressures that they're facing and what solutions there might be for them. I would also include younger staff in that, particularly student loans at the moment in time are going to change for people. There will be increased pressures there. So engaging with lower paid members of staff, engaging with younger members of staff to understand the pressures they're facing, seeing if there are things around working hours, around commuting, around childcare that can be offered to help ease some of those, but ultimately really pushing to say that 2-3% pay deal that I agreed at the start of the year, when inflation was expected to be lower, is that now sufficient? And what impact is it going to have on those people? I think we should be testing whether people do have the capacity to be paying their lower paid members of staff more. It is in the interest to do so, because the impacts that that's going to have on your well-being if you're driven into poverty and your ability to work is something that we should be seriously thinking about within the business community.
Yeah. And Rain, it's interesting that Nicole reference 2008, the crash and the recession, it does feel as if businesses these days probably think about their roles and their responsibilities quite differently than they did 15 years ago, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just awareness around mental health. And I think also it's clear, and all of this sort of survey evidence suggests that actually financial stress can be a real trigger and a real pressure for people's mental health and well-being. So I think there's a much greater awareness. And I think businesses do see themselves as playing a bigger role in helping to support some of the big challenges in our society. And we've seen that in the response to the war in Ukraine and supporting humanitarian efforts there. But and it's on a different scale, but there will be, you know, households in real who will really struggle this year in the UK. And I think just to build on what Nicole was saying, there are some, you know, thinking as well within your organization around what you can do around saving schemes, et cetera. There's been some great work by an organization we've worked with called Salary Finance, which helps works with businesses to set up saving schemes within their company to really help people through hard times. So I think thinking what you can do as well with your employees in that space is really important. Building on all the ideas that Nicole put forward.
Yeah, and again, just to pick up on another thing that Nicole said, the wages are going to come under pressure, aren't they? And, you know, I'm old enough to remember my dad certainly getting more than one pay rise a year because inflation was running so hot at the time. And I see this morning that Transport for London seems to have settled something around 8% for drivers on the tube. So you can see that, you know, the potential for new benchmarks, and we haven't been used to this for a very long time. As a general principle, do you think employers should be open to revisiting pay settlements they've just done in the way that Nicole was talking about?
I mean, I think, you know, businesses getting used to, it's been a long time since we've been operating in a world of high inflation. And I think that does change our business models. And of course, it has a huge implications for people's pay, for people's take home pay and what that means for their living standards. But whether it's thinking about, you know, businesses will need to revisit the prices they charge on a more regular basis, right? Because inflation is hitting the cost of inputs. And if you're in a competitive business that, you know, really hits, you know, eats into your margins, and people will need to revisit that. So I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see businesses looking at their overall pay settlements and seeing whether they do need to revisit that more frequently. And of course, it depends what happens, I think, with inflation itself. And we can hope, but it's maybe more a hope than an expectation that you know, maybe some of these really high spikes in inflation will start to come down. But obviously that at the moment, that's really related to the conflict, to what's happening in energy prices and food supply prices globally.
Nigel, let me come back to you. We've just got two or three minutes left. When we look back on this period, I think one of the criticisms of the Chancellor was that there was no mention of net zero. There wasn't a sort of particularly green colour to yesterday's spring statement. Perhaps you can understand why. But do you think this next period that we're going through is going to be good for the kind of business that you're in, that it will hurry us towards a low carbon future, investment in sustainability, all those things that we want to see? Where do you think that nets out?
I do think that, you know, there is a sort of sensible realization here that energy security and energy sustainability are actually the same thing. And the UK at least has a considerable natural advantage in this for the, you know, the reason we're all very familiar with, which is we live on a occasionally sunny, windy, tide-driven island. So we, you know, we of all countries should be able to make significant strides towards a fully renewable grid, potentially backed up by nuclear power stations, more quickly than other countries. And if it accelerates that, I think it is both good for our environmental commitments, but actually good for us as an economy and a society, because the roots of this problem, and arguably the roots of the war, if anything else, stem entirely from a dependence built up over the last two decades on Russian hydrocarbons. It's what's kind of, you know, given them the money, and frankly given them the sort of brass neck to think they'd get away with it, because it baked in a massive amount of dependence on them across much of Europe. And I think if we can fix that, that's a real rallying call.
And from the perspective of good energy, you're still intending to invest in the way that you were planning to invest, and have your plans changed as a result of the sort of changing growth forecasts and environment generally?
Yes, well, you'll see us sort of downplaying our supply business. We're not abandoning it at all, but if your supply business expands very quickly, you need the working capital to cover the energy shocks that we've been seeing. So you need to be quite careful about how you do that. And so you'll see an increasing focus from us on the technologies and services that help people adopt green power, be that generating their own power, driving an electric vehicle, becoming self-sufficient in their own homes, which are, I think, the sort of the energy, was what the stuff of the energy company of the future. And that's quite an exciting mission to be on. We just need to make sure that the headaches of being in the energy supply business don't overwhelm us in the process.
Nigel, thank you very much. Nicole and Rain too. We are out of time. I mean, it feels like we're in a bit of a holding pattern, doesn't it? I think that what I take away from this conversation is that the energy plan to come, the budget in the autumn to come, the Chancellor who wants one financial event a year, not multiple ones. So for a whole host of reasons, if yesterday's spring statement has left a number of people feeling slightly disappointed, I think the battle is on to make sure that the next one is better, and I'm sure that's where Rain and the CBI will come in. But for today, thank you so much for joining us. The next webinar is next Wednesday, when we're going to be looking at levelling up with the CBI's new Director of Thriving Nations and Regions and some members of his steering board. So look forward to that one. But for today, thank you all for joining in, and we'll see you soon.